This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on March 4th, 2010. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The audit hearing for the AFL-CIO Committee on Political Education, Political Contributions Committee will now come to order. This hearing is being conducted pursuant to a procedure adopted by the Commission last year that provides committees being audited by the Commission an opportunity to a hearing before the Commission prior to the Commission's adoption of a final audit report. Representing the AFL-CIO COPE Committee is Larry Gold, and feel free to take a seat here at the table. The hearing will last 1 hour. Mr. Gold, you will have up to 15 minutes to make an opening statement, if you choose to make one. And following your presentation, the commissioners, the general counsel, and the staff director will have the opportunity to ask you direct questions. And in addition, the commissioners may also ask questions of the general counsel and staff director for clarification purposes. And then at the end of today's hearing, you can have up to 5 minutes to kind of sum up your presentation if you so choose to make a closing statement. Because this hearing is being held in open session, there will be no written transcript. However, in accordance with the Commission's current policy regarding open sessions, an audio recording of this hearing will be placed on the Commission's website. So, again, good morning, Mr. Gold, and when you're ready, proceed with your opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today in this proceeding concerning the audit of AFL-CIO Co-PCC, the Federal Political Committee, the separate segregated fund of the AFL-CIO. I do want to make a few opening remarks. I doubt I'll take the full 15 minutes, and I look forward to questions that you pose to me as well as to the general counsel or the audit staff. At issue in this audit is not the basic arrangement that the AFL-CIO COPE has had with the SSFs of its affiliated unions for the last 30 years. I think that the audit division has conceded that the essential relationship between the two as far as collecting funds both for themselves and for AFL-CIO COPE is permissible and lawful. What is at issue is whether or not the AFL-CIO COPE and the SSFs with which it had these arrangements had to follow to the letter certain provisions of 102.6, namely the maintenance of a transmittal account by the transferring SSF, the 10 and 30-day timeliness rules when applied to individual union members, and the record-keeping and reporting requirements, the obligation shifting over from the transferor SSF to AFL-CIO COPE. We rely for the position that we take here and for practices that have been ongoing without any change now for 30 years on the statute, the regulations, a 1979 audit report that nobody involved with the current matter was aware of until we discovered it back in January, and again, 30 years of open and fully reported practices that have occurred without objection by anybody at the Commission or elsewhere, or any inquiry by the Commission until a letter from the Reports Analysis Division to AFL-CIO COPE in October 2004. I would emphasize that not a single union member of the untold tens of thousands of members whose contributions to their SSFs were made jointly to that SSF and AFL-CIO COPE has ever objected to these practices as far as we are aware. So since at least 1975, this is what the arrangement has consisted of. The AFL-CIO and its affiliated unions have a common restricted class in the sense that the AFL-CIO, as you know, is a federation of national labor organizations, and any member of an affiliated union is also a member of the AFL-CIO. So there's a vertical common restricted class, not lateral between unions, but vertical in the sense of the AFL-CIO being the federation of all of these unions. That is a unique situation to labor federations and other federated membership organizations. This is not just a union context. Individual members of affiliated unions who contribute by payroll deduction, which is almost universally how it's done, execute in these joint fundraising arrangements authorization cards that list both the SSF of their national union and AFL-CIO COPE, and I don't think there's any dispute that that happened here. So the card itself or the form that they authorize for the payroll deduction, consistent with the commission's rules, designate both SSFs as the recipient of their contributions. In 30 years, there has been full compliance by the SSFs involved here with all contribution limits. No member, as far as we are aware, contributed more than $5,000 to his or her SSF of the union or AFL-CIO COPE, however the analysis is made. Indeed, it is rare, if ever happens, and may never happen, that any individual union member contributes as much as $5,000 a year to his or her union PAC. I mean, typically, what we're talking about are contributions under $100, even by payroll deduction, over the course of a year. Rarely reach the individual contribution limit for a single SSF. All of the transactions here have been fully reported and itemized in this sense. The union SSF that collected the payroll deducted contributions from the individual members fully in their own accounting systems would attribute all of these contributions as contributions to that SSF, and if the $200.01 threshold was reached, then that individual member would be duly reported on reports to the commission. And there's no dispute that that has happened throughout these 30 years. So everybody who, any individual member, their contributions were reported consistently with how individual contributions are reported to any PAC or SSF, and there's no dispute about that. These arrangements have not resulted, I think, in any more funds being raised collectively for these recipients than they would have been had there been no joint fundraising arrangement. The individuals execute authorizations which specify that their funds are to be remitted to the SSF of their national union, and then they delegate to that national union and the AFL-CIO PAC the decision as to how much, if any, of those contributions eventually will be transferred over to AFL-CIO COPE. Now, again, I've alluded to the fact that there's been a long history here, a long and unbroken history since 1975. And the letters I've submitted here in November and January itemize some of that. And today, and I apologize that it's just before the hearing, but today, after some, we did some recalculations, and hopefully before you is an additional document entitled Joint Fundraising Transfers Minus $5,000 per source per year. And what this reflects is, year by year, looking at the top page, and let me say, this has been assembled from our analysis of the reports, the Forms 3X that AFL-CIO COPECC has filed with the commission over this entire period. Every source that we have been able to find, and the commission's own records, there may be, if somebody were to redo this again, some very minor discrepancies, but this is our best and honest effort here, and I think it is accurate. In any event, what this shows is for each year what the overage is. If you take every transferring SSF in each year and you subtract $5,000 from the total transferred, this is the overage, so to speak, above the usual $5,000 arm's length PAC to PAC limit that was transferred from SSFs to the AFL-CIO. And you can see year after year after year, it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, even exceeded $1 million 12 years ago. A total of $13.2 million has transferred over. Of that figure, just looking at the period of time between 1980 and 2004, that is after the 1979 audit, which I'll talk about in a minute, until RAD sent its first letter asking about these arrangements, there were $11.2 million of this $13.2 million were transferred in that 25-year period. All told, there were 1,021 joint fundraising transfers. 450 or so of these themselves exceeded the $5,000 limit. Many, many more of them, of course, added up to aggregate exceeding of a $5,000. And what's the significance of that? The significance, of course, is if there was any problem with this or any issue with this, that's what would trigger, you would think, an inquiry or an objection or something, either by the reports analysis division, somebody else at the commission, a union member, or anybody out there scrutinizing reports filed by the AFL-CIO and other union political committees, never happened until that RAD letter in 2004. The rest of this handout today is an itemization of what I just described. It shows in each year, each SSF, and the overage by each SSF in a given year. So, and the totals there are 226 instances of, over this period of time, 226 instances of a particular SSF transferring more than $5,000 a year, 226. Of those, 172 occurred in that 25-year period between the 1979 audit and the RAD letter of October 2004. So it's a long history here. We rely on the lawfulness of this, on the statute, as I said, the regulations, the audit, and this history, openly reported history. 441A5, of course, explicitly permits and exempts from the usual contribution limits transfers between political committees that are engaged in joint fundraising. 110.3C2, and I just want to summarize here because we've laid it out in our submissions, specifies joint fundraising arrangements and distinguishes joint fundraising arrangements generally from those that are actually regulated by 102.17. What we've had here for 30 years is a combined collecting agent joint fundraising relationship, but 102.6 does not trump that relationship as spelled out in the 1979 audit, and Section 102.17, the joint fundraising regulations of the Commission specifically do not apply to separate segregated funds. Yet, of course, separate segregated funds can do joint fundraising. It is perfectly lawful for them to do so. And the Commission, as far as we can tell, has addressed that sort of arrangement only once in its history, namely the 1979 audit. And even the collecting agent regulations themselves recognize that an SSF that is a collecting agent can also collect funds for itself at the same time. That's 102.6B4. No regulation imposes specific requirements on a combined collecting agent joint fundraising relationship like the one here. And we believe that if the Commission wanted to or felt it was necessary and that it had authority to do so, that would have to initiate a further rulemaking in order to address that. And absent a regulation that says that what the AFL-CIO and its affiliated unions have been doing without objection for 30 years is impermissible, we believe it is permissible, and that is a very important principle that the Commission follows across the board. Let's take a look at that 1983 rulemaking and the audit, which has been raised by the Office of General Counsel in the submission they made in response to our January letter just last week. First, let me point out that the Office of General Counsel admits that or acknowledges that the impact of the 1981 to 83 rulemaking is, quote, unclear on the issue that is before you. But if you look at the rulemaking record, and I've read all the comments and the rulemaking record of that rulemaking, what the AFL-CIO requested for a number of reasons in 1981 in the rulemaking, which took place or was initiated 2 years after that audit report, was that the proposed new 102.7, now 102.17, regarding joint fundraising not apply to SSFs, not apply to political committees that are contemplated by Section 441B. That was half the commenters in that rulemaking were labor organizations, and the other two, the Laborers International Union and the Operating Engineers International Union, both echoed the AFL-CIO's comments. No commenter suggested anything different here, and in our view, looking at what happened, the Commission obliged. The Commission did exempt SSFs explicitly from 102.7 at the time, now 102.17, the joint fundraising regulations. And that cannot possibly mean that 102.6, as it was revised at the time, trumped the joint fundraising aspect of the relationship between the AFL-CIO and its affiliated unions. Again, half the commenters, no commenter objected to the path that the AFL-CIO suggested, and the rulemaking is best read as confirming the ongoing arrangements that were explicitly endorsed by the 1979 audit and what, in fact, ensued afterward. Well, if you look at the record, especially the handout that I distributed today, you'll see the year after the audit in 1980, looking ahead to 1983 and 1984, after the conclusion of that rulemaking, in 1983, five SSFs transferred $89,000 in excess of the ordinary $5,000 a year limit. In 1984, $423,000, 1985, $255,000, and so on. In other words, clearly, everybody at the commission at the time, at the conclusion of the rulemaking, realized, understood, as did the affected bodies, the AFL-CIO and its affiliated unions, that that rulemaking confirmed the practices that had happened. Now, insofar as there is any doubt about that, and you know, I've read, as I said, the rulemaking record. I know you have as well, and it's not it is not, you know, there's not complete clarity here as to what it did or what it said in certain respects, or how, as OGC pointed out, the commission specifically responded in so many words to the AFL-CIO's comments. But this, I think, is a real case of the dog that did not bark. You have a situation where there was an audit, there were practices, there was a rulemaking, and the practices continued openly and in the same explicit manner month after month, year after year. And after all, why are we here? The only reason we're here today is that a RAD analyst 6 years ago, almost 6 years ago, without regard, without understanding or knowing about the history here or the 1979 audit, or indeed understanding, as far as I can tell, the basic structure of the labor movement and the AFL-CIO and its affiliated unions, even though the commission's regulations explicitly acknowledge them, sent a letter to the AFL-CIO COPE asking, are you affiliated with the CWA COPE, one of those SSFs? And, you know, from that ensued correspondence, which we attached, showing, you know, year in, year out, with long pauses, some very frustrating engagement with RAD about this. Throughout the audit, which was initiated without any recollection by the audit division itself of its own audit 28 years before at that time, until the OGC memorandum of February 24, there was never an acknowledgement throughout this whole process of this long history that I'm talking about, long history and the long past practice. And there's really been no explanation whatsoever why it is that there was this loss of institutional memory. Now, we certainly regret that we too did not have current institutional memory of this 1979 audit. We just stumbled upon it further preparing for the hearing that was scheduled in January. But I think what it can only mean is that your predecessors, both at the commission level and at the staff level, understood and agreed that as the 1979 audit explicitly stated, that the practices that were engaged in were lawful and appropriate under the commission's regulations. No rulemaking, no statutory change since then has undermined that. I think it's important to emphasize that there's a very significant history of reliance here, a history of reliance that is as old, almost as old as the commission itself, a history of reliance that precedes Buckley, precedes the 1976 amendments, and precedes your tenure. That reliance includes the very basic arrangements that union members and unions and the AFL-CIO have predicated these relationships on. The reliance includes accounting systems, which are expensive and even more so now, under which all incoming receipts to the SSFs are cataloged appropriately in accordance with the Commission's regulations and reported appropriately and fully by those individual unions and not by the AFL-CIO as the transferee SSF. Again, untold thousands of members have signed authorizations on the basis on reliance of these relationships. And I want to underscore that everything is fully reported. Everything that is contributed is fully reported. And in fact, if one were to accept the notion that the reporting aspect of this, the record keeping and reporting aspect of this, should suddenly after 30 years, actually 35 years, 1975 to the present, should all of a sudden be transferred from those union SSS to the AFL-CIO. The irony here is that you're going to have a net reduction in reporting, because if you take somebody, for example, let's take a member of CWA who contributes $225 by pay reduction in a year. If one were to, through the accounting that's being requested, determine that in a given year, 195 of that ended up at CWA COPE and 30 of that ended up at the AFL-CIO COPE, then that individual contributor would not be reported. There can only be a net reduction in reporting by turning your back on 35 years of practice, asking unions and the AFL-CIO to redo their accounting systems on a principle that I think OGC acknowledges at best is unclear whether or not anything the Commission has ever done legally has upset these arrangements. So we would ask that the Commission not accept the recommendation of the Audit Division in this regard and confirm that the practices that have been engaged in are appropriate. And again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gold. We'll now open it up to questions and comments by commissioners. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as I understand the argument, you're saying that you're you engage in joint fundraising, but you're not covered by, 102.17. So what, if anything, governs your joint fundraising activity?
It's a 441A5, right. 110.3C,
right.
Two. Transfers of joint fundraising proceeds. And the 1979 audit report, which spelled out exactly how we should do it in terms of it requires, again, individual authorization for both committees, transfers of the lump sum duly reported that way. Mm-hmm. And we have complied with that. And in essence, in effect, we are complying and fully intend to comply and have said so in our papers, are committed to complying with all applicable regulations, and in most respects, in every respect except really the in virtually every respect, comply with the with all the regulations as to how money is collected and reported.
And under 110.3C2. The regulation says transfers, provided that no participating committee governed by 102.17 received more than its allocated share of the funds raised, but you're not covered by 102.17, so that piece of it wouldn't apply to you. Is that?
Yes. I mean, if you read that regulation, and it says it makes an implicit distinction. It says transfers of joint fundraising proceeds between organizations or committees participating in the joint fundraising activity, provided that no participating committee or organization governed by 11 CFR 102.17 received more than its allocated share of the funds raised. And that's because 102.17 requires specific allocations at the outset and the like. And that's not true for these arrangements.
So, as
I understand it, the Audit Division and OGC, I don't think they're not challenging the fact that the requirement of a written agreement, the requirement of a specific allocation up front, that those apply to these arrangements.
So, how are the funds allocated?
The funds are allocated. Effectively, the members of the unions, the members of the AFL-CIO, delegate to the SSFs to decide the apportionment between them. And that, in fact, is what they've been doing for 35 years.
And that just sort of on a year-to-year basis based on how much they have and how much they feel they can share? Is that?
It's predicated on, of course, how much has been collected pursuant to these arrangements, so that's even eligible to be transferred over,
right.
And then whatever other considerations are used by the two organizations. And then when the decision is made and the transfer is made, it has been reported as the 1979 audit instructed, with this notation, odd notation, mm-hmm. admittedly, but this notation, you know, joint fundraising proceeds. And again, year in, year out, that's what RAD received and reviewed and saw. And so, you know, what is fully reported is, you know, how much went from SSF, Union SSF, to AFL-CIO COP, and, of course, every individual member who contributed to both collectively over $200 was reported in the usual manner.
I hear your argument.
Okay.
I was asking a much narrower question. I'm just trying to figure out what regulations, if any, actually govern this sort of unusual hybrid arrangement. You know, it's a joint, you're doing joint fundraising, but you don't quite fall into the joint fundraising regs, and you're also sort of a collecting agent, but you say you don't fall into the, you don't think you fall into the collecting agency regs either, right?
That's correct. We don't believe we've, because if it was a pure collecting agent relationship and there was nothing received by the initial SSF, it was just a transfer point, then I think the collecting agent regulations would apply, and we acknowledge that. In fact, the 1979 audit, I think itself, makes that kind of a distinction, and that's fine. We accept that. But for whatever reason, and it, from the beginning – in 1983, the commission has not imposed particular rules specific to the SSFs that are excluded from 102.17. I grant you that it could be viewed as a bit odd, but we do have a 35-year history here.
And your argument on the collecting agent, why those particular requirements don't apply, is that it's not a local, national, or international union collecting contributions on behalf of the separate segregated fund of a federation, but rather the SSF of that organization. I'm looking at 102.6.
Right.
B.
It's not just a collecting agent. It's this hybrid, inherently hybrid relationship where it is acting both, the SSF of the particular union is acting both, in fact, you know, de facto as a collecting agent for AFL-CIO COP insofar as anything is transferred, but it is also chiefly raising funds for itself by its own restricted class, common restricted class, and the individual members authorize the initial remittance of the payroll deducted contributions to their own SSF. That's what they authorize, and that's what the SSF follows, and then later makes a determination along with AFL-CIO COP. Okay, we've raised $100,000 through this joint fundraising effort. We could transfer all $100,000 over. We're sending $50,000 over. Reports the 50 as the transfer. 50 is reported in all other record keeping requirements. You know, looking at it as the SSF itself, the union SSF, is fully complying with all of the regulations in 104 and otherwise in raising funds with the appropriate, you know, solicitations, raising funds, record keeping, and reporting. So this is not, it's important not to consider this to be some kind of, you know, lawless, outlier or something. It's not. It's unusual. It's going to be confined, it apparently is confined, to situations where you have these joint restricted classes in a federated manner where you can have, where the, you know, everybody can solicit the same.
So your understanding of the 83 rulemaking was that in setting up rules for collecting agents and rules for joint fundraisers, they intentionally did not intend to occupy the waterfront, to occupy the entire field with those two sets of regulations, that there would be entities, you in particular, that, and they were well aware of that because you submitted comments, not the other Larry Gold, not right. you. But being aware that there were these entities out there like you, they intentionally left you not in one box and not in the other box.
That's correct. And keep in mind that rulemaking took place. It was initiated barely 2 years after the 1979 audit, which was, you know, and with, I think, the same staff personnel. And I have
fresh in everybody's memories back then,
right.
unlike now.
Well, this was right on the heels of that. It's not a situation where we're all sitting here and none of us and none of the staff apparently even remembered what happened 30 years ago. Okay, this is a situation we had a rulemaking, an audit that concluded in mid-1979, a rulemaking that commenced in 1981 and concluded in 1983. It was the same group, I believe, for the most part, there. And
some of my colleagues were barely in grade school back then.
Right. And so the only thing in common between the two is probably my name. But
and even that's a coincidence.
Right, it is. But the point is that I think the commission at that time, these were contemporaneous events and a contemporaneous understanding of what the impact of that rulemaking was. And I think the proof of that understanding, insofar as there's ambiguity here, and I don't deny that there is some ambiguity here, is the fact that the practices continued unabated, totally openly, month in, month out, with reports to the commission. And I have to believe that if this rulemaking had wrought some fundamental change to this and basically revoked the 1979 audit, that you know something would have been said, and it would have said so. But that did not happen.
Commissioner Walther.
Good question. Thank you. What precipitated the 81 rulemaking? Do you have any idea?
I don't.
Wasn't to solve any issue here.
Not that I'm aware of. I really don't know what precipitated.
Looks like everybody's records are pretty vacant on all that.
Yeah. I mean, I've looked at the record, the NPRM, the final ENJ, and the regulations, and all the comments. There were not that many comments submitted. There were 6 comments submitted.
You know, it sounds like, for me, you've gone so many years, and there's never been a problem with the accuracy or the issue relating to the reporting aspect. It's just how what crack you fit in, and there's no clear answer. And to me, going forward, it's hard to write you up now, in my opinion, because of our history. And it's hard, I mean, maybe both sides could have done a little more, but it certainly wasn't something that caused, an inappropriate result. And I'm just thinking, and going forward, what's the best way for us to look at how to not make this so onerous that you can't do it, but also maybe keep this practice one that we can countenance and find a name for it. I mean, I don't know quite how to procedurally do it, and I apologize for being late, but that was one of the things that we were talking about in our office, and we just got carried away with the iterations, yeah. And so you ended up waiting for another 10 minutes. I'm sorry about that. But do you have any ideas on going forward? What would be the mend?
Well, I think going forward, again, it's not as if there are no rules that apply here. And I think that's really is important to underscore. We believe that this is not just a matter where the commission should confirm that that AFL-CIO doesn't have to amend reports in 2005 and 2006. This is, after all, a conventional audit in a certain sense of a 2-year period. So I don't think it's enough to say, okay, well, you don't have to change those reports, but going forward, you have to change everything. I don't think the commission really does have the authority to go forward in this audit and say, now you've got to change everything that you're doing, that somehow 35 years you've been doing it wrong and the law somehow is different. I don't believe that's the case. So I think that we can continue and we'll commit to doing what we have. We've said, in fact, that as far as the 10 and 30-day timeliness rules, we think we've complied with them, certainly with respect to the transfers that were at issue in this audit, given the volume of incoming receipts to the particular unions, and can commit to complying with those in the future. But we don't think that it's required. Again, I want to underscore, the SSFs themselves, the union SSFs, have to follow all the 104 and all the usual rules. The only difference really here is, I think, for, you know, do they have to set up some separate transmittal account? And we don't see, you know, we don't think so, because, again, the transfer over is in some sense it's disaggregated from the individual contribution. Do they have to send records, suddenly redo all their accounting systems in order to produce a reporting result that will result in a net less reporting to the commission? That doesn't seem to make any sense. So I think that if the commission is going to thinks that this ought to be revisited somehow, then I think the commission ought to consider doing it as a rulemaking, and you know, then we would deal with it in that posture.
Just if I could quickly follow up, is there, not only should we consider it as a rulemaking, is there any other vehicle by which we could alter our course than through rulemaking, yeah, in your opinion?
Well, I think that, I guess I think not, because the rules themselves, I think there's a path through the current rules themselves that enables these arrangements to take place. I've spelled that out in our submissions. I've tried to summarize that here. And I think that's the appropriate way. I'm not sure how else the commission would do it other than certainly an enforcement action would be an appropriate a policy statement. I don't think that has, you know, it doesn't have the force of law, and it would not be the way to do it. And nobody's asked for an advisory opinion, and we're not going to at this point. I mean, I think this is we didn't ask for the audit, and the audit was, you know, the audit itself is an irony in a way, because the audit is triggered by concern by, you know, the audit division and others here about practices that the same audit division, unbeknownst to itself, had endorsed 28 years before. So it's kind of a series of accidental steps that even brings us here. I know that's a long answer to your question, but I think a rulemaking would be the appropriate way going forward if the commission were to contemplate any changes in these arrangements.
Okay. The Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just one a brief factual question. You've used the word affiliated. I assume you're using it in a non-regulatory definition for these purposes?
If I refer to the unions as affiliated with the AFL, yes, I did. And I made that point, I think, in a footnote in one of my submissions. It's affiliated within the constitutional organic relationship between these bodies, not affiliated within the meaning of the Act.
Right. And that was actually what raised my question. There's the second sentence of footnote 3 in your submission says, except for the Transportation Trades Department and AFL-CIO, I assume Michigan COPE, none of the listed committees was so affiliated with AFL-CIO COPE PCC. And I want to make sure is the so affiliated in that clause of the sentence mean that they are affiliated for a regulatory purpose, or are those the two that are affiliated in the constitutional relationship purposes?
Okay. TTD and AFL-CIO Michigan COPE are affiliated within the meaning of your regulations.
Okay.
Because they are subordinate bodies within the AFL-CIO itself. They're not national, international unions that are affiliated in the organic, non-FICA sense.
Okay.
With the AFL. And the reason I put the footnote in was because the audit division had used the term affiliated, and I understood that they were not using it in the regulatory sense. And I just wanted to point that out. So.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understood. There were three uses of affiliated in those two sentences, and I understand two meant one thing and not the other thing. Thank you.
We use the term affiliates. That is, the AFL-CIO uses affiliated as the affiliates. That's the common terminology, which precedes yours. So,
further questions? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where to begin? Probably with the statute. That's probably a good place to begin. My sense of this reg that's been cited is it seems to have been part of a bunch of rulemakings that came about after the 79 amendments. And if you go back and look at the 79 amendments, particularly the legislative history, which I think Mr. Aldacker recounts in a response to a RAD letter on behalf of not your client, but another client that seemed to be in the same spot, it seemed upon reading it that there was quite a bit of legislative history that didn't speak generally about what your client's done, but rather specifically. And it seemed to me that Congress did not intend for this to be prohibited, looking upon that, reading that legislative history. Would you agree with that?
I mean, I would generally. I've looked at the legislative history of 1979 amendments, and I saw nothing there that would undermine what the contemporaneous audit report had concluded. Certainly in this audit, OGC has not, I don't believe, referred to the 1979 amendments at all as relating to this. They've only focused in a very tentative manner on the 1983 rulemaking.
And that rulemaking, assuming I'm reading the history right, and it came about as one of many rulemakings after the 79 amendments, it seems to me that the rule can't possibly go beyond what the statute was intended to do. So regardless of how one may be able to contort the regulation today, it still has a limit on the reach of the statute. Do you agree with that?
Yes, of course.
I mean, that's black letter law.
Yes.
And the audit, as I understand it, was rather, and I've read it, it seems very specific to me, to your client, as to how to proceed post-audit, audit meaning the 1979 audit, not the current audit.
Right.
And as best I can tell, your client has done just that. I don't see anything in the record that indicates your client has done anything other than what it was told to do 30 years ago.
That's true, and I think that that fact is underscored by the fact that my client currently and for years obviously didn't remember the 1979 audit, but practices and procedures were put in place, well, confirmed by that audit. If they were at all different at the time, adjusted to conform with it, and they have been faithfully followed by a succession of AFL-CIO staff today. And I should introduce Kim Farrell, who is the PAC director of the AFL-CIO, who is accompanying me today, and she's been doing this faithfully for years. And she is, in fact, the one who discovered the records of the 1979 audit and working with me to prepare for this hearing.
It makes sense that there was some point in history where something happened, because it seems ridiculous that this many years would have gone by with such a large labor federation doing it a certain way, and that your client would have just made it up. That made no sense instinctively. And once the audit was discovered and presented by you, it made a lot more sense. So really, I'd like to actually ask a question of Mr. Stoltz. Given what Mr. Gold has said, and given that the audit division audited this person 30 years ago, does the audit division have anything to say for itself?
Excuse me. Obviously, we regret that this didn't come to light sooner as well. I think the question then boils down to what was the impact of the 83 rulemaking.
Well, before we get to that, let me ask you the real question. Was audit aware that it had audited AFL-CIO 30 years ago while it was conducting the current audit?
We have record that the audit occurred.
So
in the normal course, one of the things we routinely do is review all the previous audit reports, advisory opinions, open and close compliance actions in order to be informed about the history of this committee or whatever committee we're auditing. Unfortunately, this one did not come to light in that process. We have certainly taken steps since to make that nearly impossible in the future, but it did not.
Okay, let me ask the same question again, because I heard some inconsistency in your answer, because the initial part of your answer indicated that audit did know about the prior audit, but then you conclude it by saying it seemed audit didn't know. So let me ask you, did you know about this audit while audit was conducting the current audit? Meaning, did you know about the 79 audit while the current audit was underway?
I recalled that we had done it. the only copy in the building, it turns out, is the one on microfilm downstairs. And in the normal course, that should have been retrieved and considered, and in this case, it wasn't.
If you would have known about the prior audit, and I take from your answer, I guess you did know about it, you just didn't check?
In the pre-audit process, it should have been discovered and retrieved, and it was not.
Okay. So audit was unaware of this audit until Mr. Gold presented it?
Well, unaware of the contents, anyhow. Like I said, I knew that there had been one.
Oh, so we knew there was an AFL-CIO audit 30 years ago, but we were unaware of the subject matter.
Long since forgotten the subject matter.
Okay. But it was in the building. It was just on microfiche downstairs.
That's correct.
Do we agree now that having read the 79 audit, that it is the same subject matter as the current audit?
It is, from all indications, the same subject matter as the current audit. As I said earlier, the question is, has the regulatory scheme changed in such a way as to change the outcome?
And the Office of General Counsel says the answer to that question is unclear.
That's correct.
As I hear Mr. Gold's argument, he's referring to this as joint fundraising, but it's really not joint fundraising. It seems that your client has called it joint fundraising because that's what this 79 audit told you to call it. We can call it whatever we want to call it, but the subsequent reg maybe has now confused and made it more of a term of art than it probably was in 79. Seems to me this is a sui generis situation. I don't know enough about your client, Federation of Audits and that sort of thing, but I know enough, Federation of Audits, Federation of Unions and that sort of thing, but I know enough to know that I don't know, but it seems to me, given the constitutional overlay that governs unions, not just First Amendment speech rights, but associational rights, we have to be very careful when we go inside the four walls of the union hall and decide what we can and can't do with respect to how you conduct yourself. I don't hear any issues here on contribution limits. It seems to me that the system in place adheres to the contribution limits. Is that correct?
It does, because
you don't have folks double dipping, meaning people are not double maxing and getting around limits by moving money from pack to pack or anything like that, correct?
Right. And let me be specific about that, and we do cover it in one of the letters. Since all of the contributions go from the member to his or her own union SSF, that union SSF is monitoring a contribution limit. And as I say, it's rare, if ever, that any union member even approaches the $5,000 to his or her own SSF. And it's only from that SSF that anything would be transferred to AFL-CIO COPE. So in that, and thirdly, none of these members contributes directly to AFL-CIO COPE. AFL-CIO COPE does not. It's not that it can't. It can lawfully, separately solicit members of its affiliated unions. It does not. It never does. It never has. And that is because of the institutional relationships within the labor movement, that the AFL-CIO honors the fact that all of its affiliated unions have their own PACs and does not solicit those members. So that never happens. If it were to happen, and I'm telling you, it never happens. If it were to happen and there was a joint fundraising arrangement, then that would be monitored, but it doesn't happen. So there is no, again, there is no contribution limit issue, and none has been suggested throughout this process by the audit division.
And similarly, although I guess a different question, when your union members agree to the payroll deduction, there's no issue as to you're doing anything with the money that they didn't consent to, right? It's clear, as I read the record, that they know the process, the money is going to go to one place and then could be moved to other places, and I'm using layman's terms.
Right.
But there's no issue about union members being kept in the dark here. It seems like they are fully aware and have agreed, and this is voluntary, and it's clear that the system you're using, they're in on it, so to speak.
And that's correct. I mean, they initiated in the sense, I mean, they're certainly solicited to contribute to both, but it's their own voluntary execution of a specific authorization that does this. And if you look at the handout today, you know, this is even in the years where you had, say, even a dozen unions that were involved in these joint fundraising arrangements, using that term the way it's just used colloquially anyway, most unions are not reflected here, because it's only where those cards exist and those authorizations exist that do that joint specific individual authorization that these arrangements are entered into. And both the SSF and the AFL-CIO COPE make sure of that. And other unions have not solicited their members to do this. So we can't do joint fundraising in the same manner with those organizations, and we don't.
Joint fundraising or whatever this is.
Right. It's right.
The hybrid.
Right.
Let me get another question from Mr. Stoltz. If it's unclear whether or not the reg changed the audit, or whether the reg even covers this, why is it taking this long for this to get to the commission? My guess is the answer is we don't have any procedures in place for this to come to the commission sooner. But it seems like there's been a lot of years have elapsed since this began, and now here we are, first time the commission has considered this.
You mean starting from?
Let's start at the beginning of the audit.
Beginning of the audit. At the beginning of the audit, it was the opinion of, you know, the folks involved, and there's been a lot of back and forth among various groups in the agency. That
did that include the commission?
Not including the commission.
Okay,
staff,
thank you.
That this had to fall in either a collecting agent or joint fundraising situation, and so that was the approach that we took. And obviously we did bring forward the interim audit report, and that was approved, along with legal analysis attached thereto.
Which did not cite this prior audit.
Did not cite the prior audit.
So that was not brought to the attention of the commission.
That part was not.
Even though it's contrary authority.
That part was not. And, you know, we would have if we would have had located it, but as I think I said, unfortunately, we did not.
So we have a statute with legislative history that seems to say almost directly that these unions can essentially conduct themselves as they're conducting themselves. An audit that instructed them how to do that in some detail. A rule where they commented, and there were changes to the rule, at least in the title of the rule, that seemed to be consistent with their request. Whether or not the commission intentionally ignored the other requests in the rulemaking, or didn't feel the rule covered it, will remain unknown, but today we agree it's unclear whether we still know the answer. So the agency's decision from 79, as I can tell, has not been reversed by anything that would require to any sort of notice that would be sufficient. So, like Chairman Walther, I'm wondering where we go from here, because I think the merits are rather clear. Let me ask this from Mr. Gold. And sort of following up on the vice chair's question, your client and maybe clients are affiliated, let's say, in the constitutional sense. But for purposes of regulation, it's not affiliated in the FEC sense. What if your clients were affiliated in the FEC sense, these transfers would not be an issue.
Correct.
My sense is the reports analysis division had seemed to think you were affiliated all those years, and once they asked the question, are you affiliated, and the response was no, that's really what triggered this. I did a little bit of my own investigation. It wasn't that somehow they just changed. I think they were on an assumption. What if your clients, and of course it's not up to us to suggest that your clients affiliate, but maybe explain to us the complexities, downside, administrative headache, and anything else that would be a reason why you wouldn't affiliate, to simply allow this to just go away?
Well, affiliate in the
FEC sense of the word, yes.
Right. Well, it's not. I don't think it's in our power to affiliate in the FEC sense. I mean, you've got the when the statute was enacted and amended in the 1970s, and regulations were put in that had to do with membership, defining membership and defining vertically. The regulations specifically say that we are not affiliated in the FEC sense. That is, the AFL-CIO or any labor federation, and there is another one now, is not affiliated with the national unions that are its members with a small m. We don't call them that any more than a trade association is affiliated with the businesses and the like that join together in that trade association. So we don't have.
We assume Congress was well aware of the AFL-CIO and its structure. At least some members of Congress probably had been members of some union at some point. And my guess is the law was crafted in a way that they drew lines.
Oh, that's explicitly clear. There's no question. The legislative history itself is explicit about that.
Couldn't be clearer.
Right. You know, it's the AFL-CIO. It's discussed at the time. The other Larry Gold I know participated in the whatever was involved in the drafting of it.
Which is not you.
It's just not me.
Maybe we could have an audit on that to get to the bottom of that coincidence.
Right. So we don't have it in our power in any event, nor the desire to affiliate in the FEC sense. I mean, this is an historic structure of the labor movement, which precedes the Act by a long period of time, and the Act took that into account. Congress took that into account in the 1970s when it fashioned it.
Seems to me Congress didn't want to change how your client operated. And now here we are trying to change how your client operated years and years later through an audit. Even though the first audit, you had to make some changes, I think, on the first. I think there were some details there, but it was a situation where the recommendation, if you do it a certain way, great detail, then you'll be fine. And now all of a sudden...
Right. I think that's true. And I'm surprised to hear, I guess, that RAD believed that we were affiliated, some at RAD believed we were affiliated. That was certainly the first question out of the box in October of 2004 when we got that letter.
Well, I think it was a conclusion drawn from seeing the transfers, because I think the assumption is you're not going to move tens of thousands of dollars at one time, because I think the assumption is we know the contribution limit. So if you're doing that, there must be a reason. The most obvious reason is must be affiliated, right? That's the easy reason. So you ask the question, are you affiliated?
Right. And right. That makes a certain amount of sense. And then, of course, underscores then that somebody forgot something, because it was certainly known in the 1979 audit that there was no affiliation. This 1979 audit postdated the Act and all the significant amendments of the Act, which recognized these structures. And we never pretended to be affiliated in the FEC sense. Just anybody who has even a casual understanding of the structure of the labor movement would know that we're not affiliated in that sense, that these are distinct autonomous organizations. And the regulations themselves spell that out, and they've always spelled that out. So whatever anybody at RAD might have thought over the years, they were not reading, as far as I'm concerned, if that was the case, they were not looking at the specific regulations that spell out how a federation of labor organizations relates to its affiliated unions in the constitutional sense.
So simply affiliating to solve this, that's not an answer, because the affiliation in the FEC sense is something that postdates how you're conducting yourself. Congress didn't force that on you, nor could they. I think that would have been an easy case for your client to win. But then where do we go from here? It seems to me calling this joint fundraising creates some problems, because it's not really joint fundraising. Remember when I joined the commission, we've had some cases along the way where folks had done some events, and I my view coming in was you didn't always have to do joint fundraising under the reg. And some were shocked and thought I was from the moon when I said that. And I know it came from somewhere, but it was something that was just passed down. I learned from other lawyers who had taught me that, and now at least I know, I think, where the genesis of this was, is that those around at the time didn't think you always had to follow these regs, and maybe it doesn't make me right in the case I was talking about, but it at least lets me know there is some genesis to this idea that's real. So on the reporting side, maybe if we figure out, is there a different way to report this, that we're not calling it joint fundraising, but yet you still are essentially doing it the same way? Because if we change, I guess a two-part question, is there a way to just change the report so that it's more consistent with the regs? Or two, if that doesn't work, to all of a sudden come under these regulations would probably cause an administrative headache, to say the least, that would exponentially dwarf the headache that you've had to endure for the past several years. So could you maybe elaborate on going forward? Because the Audit Division recommended you change your practices. You said no.
Right.
I guess my question is, why?
Right. Well, I think if there's going to be a change here, it ought to be a change in Form 3X to add a line that reflects this sort of a payment from one SSF to another. We have done it. We did it. The AFL did it. And the SSFs did it as the 1979 audit requested. But the form itself is confusing. There's a line that says transfers. But transfers is a broader concept. We've also put it in the unitemized portion, maybe the form ought to be a separate line added to the form in order to capture this kind of a payment. And we would certainly have no problem with that. We have always tried to report it in accordance with how we felt the commission wanted us to report it. That's never been an issue, never been a point of objection. And we've done it the best we could. I thought we had done it, and I said so in the earlier correspondence before we found this audit report. I thought that we were doing it because I was so advised internally, that we had been informally advised by the Audit Division to do it in a certain way. Now I see. You'll see in some of my letters before January, acknowledging some uncertainty about what the history was or why and the like. We were doing the best we could, and then we found this, and then it came together. So that's what I would suggest.
And the audit wouldn't have been discovered, but for the fact you were probably making your client expend quite a bit of resources to dig back and go back to the beginning to defend and show the history of how many transfers had occurred and how come the commission hadn't picked it up before, and then while driving in reverse, you found this.
Well, that's what happened. As we were preparing for the, We had already made one submission that showed, just from available records from 1993 to the present, the entire history. And the Audit Division and the Office of General Counsel did not acknowledge that in its ensuing reports. And then in preparation for this, we decided to go back from the beginning, which took a lot of effort. Where we found it.
You may not want to answer this because it may be attorney-client privilege, but if you can answer it, or it may ballpark it, resource-wise, how much has this cost your client?
That I don't know.
The reason why I ask is if this were litigation and you are a litigant and Team Audit were a litigant and this happened, Rule 11 would probably rear its ugly head, and I think somebody would be paying fees. And I would also think there'd probably be a negative jury charge, and probably the evidence would be somehow excluded and all be subject to abuse of discretion and it wouldn't be reversed. Because I have to say, and this, Mr. Chairman, I think that we can't let this happen again. There needs to be some sort of procedure where there's some sort of legal question that occurs early in the process. It ought to make it to the commission sooner rather than later. RAD is not in the position to make legal judgments. RAD is in the position of reviewing reports subject to criteria the commission has approved, and if it triggers a referral, then it triggers a referral. But at some point along the line, those of us who are here to make the ultimate decision, I think, need to be involved sooner rather than later. And two, this just can't happen again. I mean, there's an audit on point, and you know, you hear that there's always the defense lawyer joke about a waive the letter of apology. But I, for myself, and not speaking for anyone else on the commission, your clients here, this should not have happened, in my view. And we can't undo it, but we can at least go forward and try to make sure it doesn't happen again. U.S. Supreme Court last term in the Fox Television case talked about agency notice and what's notice and what's not notice. Letters from RAD, in my view, are not notice. It has to be quite a bit more than that. In that case, the deciding vote, Justice Kennedy, went along with the FCC being having given enough notice, but he did note that it was not a model for agency explanation. And I think really we can't just forget our history here. And I think, you know, we've gone a long way to putting MERS online. I understand now we're moving the same direction on audits. It's in the microfiche room. If we can't find it ourselves, it's really tough for the public to find it. And if that sort of work had been done, I don't think we'd be here today. That's not really a question. That's more of a statement. I thank you for coming. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? I'll just, I guess, less of a question right now than to kind of summarize where we are. The way I look at this situation is that we had a 1979 audit which specifically blessed the arrangement that under which the AFL-CIO and its affiliates have been operating since 1979, that we'd had a 1983 rulemaking, which at most had an unclear impact on your arrangement and maybe possibly didn't have an impact at all on it. But if there were some sort of impact, that would have almost certainly come to light in the immediate aftermath of that rulemaking and not a couple days later. And then in the interim, you had basically a quarter of a century operating under that arrangement without hearing anything from any source saying that that there was any problems under the law with how you were operating. I guess I just have a quick question from counsel. In terms of the impact of that 83 rulemaking on this joint fundraising arrangement that the AFL-CIO had, how much did that weigh into our consideration? The fact that we didn't, you know, we did have the rulemaking, and to my mind, it should have come to light at that point that if there were a problem, that would have immediately become apparent to the commission and to the AFL-CIO, and yet it didn't come to light at that point, and not until many years later. What sort of how much weight should we give that consideration?
You know, as we've said in our comments, it's unclear exactly what the impact of the 1983 rulemaking is. When you look at the rulemaking record, it's not clear that the commission was clearly affirming or clearly negating the 1979 arrangement. You know, on the one hand, the reference in 102.17 to the collecting agent regulations tends to suggest that 102.17 doesn't apply to this situation, but the collecting agent regulations quite certainly could or likely could. On the other hand, we take your point quite seriously. In some senses, it's a non-legal point, but it certainly is a compelling one, that there doesn't appear to be anything in the record that clearly notified Mr. Gold's clients that the 1983 rulemaking was a negation of the arrangement that they had in 1979. And so while we don't like to bring to the commission sort of tentative judgments on things, we do think this is one where, frankly, on the one hand and on the other hand, is appropriate. And it's a place for the commission to make not a purely legal, but a judgment that I think will require your policy considerations above and beyond what we've laid out for you as the legal considerations.
Okay, thank you. Just to make one further remark, I do think that out of this, that there are some things that, that the commission should do. The commission's taken great strides in recent years to make its MER files available online for public inspection, and I think that we ought to seriously consider doing the same thing for audits. And in many ways, I don't think that that would be any heavier of a lift logistically than it is to put the MER files online, and that we should really consider doing that. And I agree with Commissioner McGann that that we need to seriously consider putting into place some sort of procedure where contentious legal issues at the outset can be resolved by the commission early, so that we don't have to, you know, wait 3, 4, 5 years later to have that debate at the commission level. The shape and form of that procedure, I think, we'd have to debate. I believe that the procedures hearing that we had last year, a little over a year ago, that suggestion was brought up. And, in fact, if my memory serves, it may have even been Mr. Gold who brought that that suggestion to our attention. And I think that that's something that we very seriously need to consider going forward. Are there any further comments or questions from the commissioners? Any questions from General Counsel?
No, thank you very much.
Commissioner Walther?
I have a question to Mr. Stoltz. If you had had that audit from day one when the audit began, what position would you have taken at that point?
Well, I think what we would have done is consulted with counsel and decided where we should come down on this. I mean, we would have done a while back, essentially, what has been going on for the last month and trying to figure out what has changed since that audit report was issued.
But if there was an issue about that, wouldn't it have come to us at some point much sooner than it did? I think, along with Commissioner McGann, procedurally for ourselves, we need to have some way to bring these things to a head. But if I understand it, if that audit was available, this whole matter would have maybe taken a different course in a different way.
I think that's very likely, yes.
Would it be possible, Mr. Stoltz, to have a line where you could identify this type of activity on a form, call it a hybrid fundraiser or a hybrid collection or a constitutional fundraiser or something like that? Well, you don't want the affiliation relationship, but and then have us maybe define this in a policy or something like that. We could go to a rulemaking, I suppose, but just trying to get this off the dime so that in the future you have a line item that identifies the issue and it isn't when all of us are gone and the third Mr. Gold is there at the AFL. We all can have something to go back to. I mean, would that be an interim thing to have for us?
I can answer that. We have a line number on the Form 3X that is line 17, other receipts. If you just put it there, because right now it's on a line transfers from affiliated committees. So I think that would clarify sort of a catch-all line.
Saying what?
It wouldn't raise the whole issue of affiliation. So it would just put it on that line and clarify it in a memo text, something to the effect of the arrangement. I mean, we could work that out, that language, you and I.
That makes sense.
Anything further? Commissioner McGann.
I think Commissioner Walther has a great suggestion. I support it. Maybe the term's constitutional affiliation. That's really what we're. I mean, just something so the public knows it's its own deal. Maybe that would work. Since we're so far afield of the substance at this point, we're thinking about the future. It my view is that unions are different creatures. So this doesn't create a whole new regime for others. It's a sui generis situation. And the old sort of corporate versus union tit for tat never made a lot of sense to me. It's probably because I was in grade school when this audit was going on. Although I remember what I was doing in 1970. I remember who I had as my teacher. So I can remember back to 1979. But it seems to me that this is not something that's going to creep into other areas because of the idiosyncrasies of the labor movement, which Congress was well aware of when they passed the act in the early 70s, amended in the mid 70s, and then 79, and even McCain-Feingold. And that's really reflected most recently in the fact that I think some of Mr. Gold's clients filed amicus briefs in Citizens United saying you don't have to reach Austin because, well, Austin was corporate. Not even sure Austin applied to unions. And I think Mr. Gold's clients had taken the position that Austin didn't apply. Unfortunately, the commission never had the chance to train wreck on that one because I'm sure that would have been fun and exciting. But I think Commissioner Walther has a good idea there going forward because I think the reports have to reflect reality. And continuing to call this joint fundraising and putting it on line 11 versus line 12, when I guess you had it on one line, but then we told you to do the other line, and that doesn't make sense. I think we can acknowledge that this is its own creature. And to me, I go back to the original statute and the legislative history for that. And that for me, allows the reg to be read in a way that doesn't reach what you're doing. So I just wanted to echo Commissioner Walther's thoughts and express support for that. Thank you.
Commissioner Hunter.
Very brief question for the audit division. Mr. Stoltz, could you have withdrawn this audit report before today's audit hearing, or did you need a vote of a commission to do that?
I think we probably could have, but counsel's analysis suggested that the hearing might be a good way to resolve the issue, and so we did not.
Thank you.
Commissioner McGann.
Procedurally, is there a way to stop the audit, terminate an audit after the ship leaves the dock? Can the commission stop an audit? Because if there's ever been a case where there might be an opportunity to say enough is enough, this seems to be the case. Has this ever come up before where a commissioner has said we've gone down the wrong road?
Do you have any experience with
that? No, I don't believe that it has.
We were deferring to Joe because our side of the table didn't have any experience with that.
Is there anything further from the staff directors side of the office?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that, Mr. Chairman?
Is there anything further from the staff director? We've given the general counsel.
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Any final thoughts? If none, Mr. Gold, we'd like to give you some time to summarize your remarks and make any final statements you'd like.
Okay. I think actually what I'd like to do is just comment a little bit about the process here. Especially in light of the fact that the discussion is focusing about how this transpired and what could be done. One thing that we found frustrating throughout this whole process was that it was, leaving aside the fact that we didn't know the history, and so we're operating ourselves in the dark for part of it, the fact that it was initiated by RAD, and we went through years of a frustrating back and forth with RAD on this, which is really not fruitful, including getting the same letters. And I've spelled this out again and again, asking the same question over and over that we responded to in previous letters, sometimes with respect to the same committee, sometimes with respect to another committee. And early on, we did ask and say, look, send this to the general counsel when we realized there was an issue. And the first time we received anything in writing, there was a meeting I think, 4 years ago that I had with several people in RAD in the General Counsel's office in a formal meeting, and it didn't resolve anything. But the first time we got anything in writing from the General Counsel was October 15, 2009, the memo that was in connection with the draft final report. And that was 5 years after the first RAD letter. And that's clearly not the best way, I think, for the commission to be operating. If there is, I think Commissioner McGann noted that, some reservations about RAD raising legal issues and the like. It seems to me that when an issue like this is joined, as it was in October 2004, the General Counsel ought to be right on it right then and there somehow. And we shouldn't have to kind of beg for something in writing from the commission that addresses the points that we were making. The submissions that you saw to you, you'll see in all the back and forth with RAD over the years, we made virtually all these points in letters to RAD and never got a substantive response in writing. Did not. And that you can, I think, certainly fix. And I'm not trying to blame. I really think that people have acted in good faith. I don't believe anybody knew about the content of the audit report, as Mr. Saltz said. You know, he didn't remember that. You know, what was in that audit report? I have no doubt that it was just forgotten, the substance of it and the existence of it for most of us. But also, an audit here was not, even if we were wrong on this, I don't think an audit was the way to go. It should have been. I mean, why audit us on something that we were completely open about what we had done? I mean, back and forth, all of a sudden we get an audit letter, and it was an audit that wasn't even limited to this. It was just, you're being audited. Now, early on, the audit division acknowledged that this was the only issue they were focusing on, but why do it through an audit? We were disclosing everything that we had, all the information that we had. You know, there was no issue about any of the material facts. I don't think we had tripped some threshold, your thresholds about audit. So why even do an audit in this situation? That's another question that we haven't focused on. But I think that in itself has delayed the resolution, because that audit was initiated in December 2007, over 2 years ago. And it just seems that, 3.5 years or 3 years plus of correspondence with RAD that then continued through the audit, 2 years of audit, bring us here today. I don't know how much has been spent by the organization to deal with this. You know, if you quantified it, I'm sure it would be a lot. And none of it was really necessary, in my view. I know you haven't made any final decisions here, but in my view, not necessary. But I think there's good food for thought for just improving what you do, and that would be helpful to everybody. So, again, we do ask that the commission not accept the recommendations of the audit division here, that the commission confirm that the practices, as we have described them and as the audit division has ascertained we are, in fact, undertaking them, be confirmed as lawful under the current rules. And if there's a specific line in the report other than what we've been using to report this now, or a new line, we would be happy to comply with that. We've always tried to report this in the best manner possible. And I thank you again for the opportunity to appear here.
Thank you, Mr. Gold. Commissioner Walter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Procedurally, we're here for a hearing and not necessarily to take action. It wasn't necessarily what we could do. I don't know if there's a consensus to do that today, but I think from the conversation we all agree that we will probably see what procedure exists to pull back a little bit on this one, and whether to disapprove it or, you know, withdraw it or that kind of thing. So is that some advice you can give us today on what procedurally is left to us, or would we just re-notice this and deal with it other than a hearing context?
I don't think our hearing procedures contemplate that we would make a decision on the day of the hearing. So I believe that at this point the commission can continue to consider the proposed final audit report and determine how each one of you would vote on it as it is, or indicate that there are some revisions that you would want to have made to it. May I, while I have the microphone, please. I just wanted to say, hope this is not inappropriate,
no,
but wanted
fine.
To thank you, Mr. Gold, for the observations that you made regarding our procedures, and also wanted to say that we, and I'm sure the audit division is as well, more than willing to engage in a conversation about how to raise issues before the commission at an earlier time. I did want to clarify, though, that in the late 2005 and spring of 2006, the Office of General Counsel was engaged in this matter because we received queries from the Reports Analysis Division, and we responded to those queries. And our legal response, while I do not want to reveal attorney-client privileged information because those are not on the record, they were consistent with the opinions that we've given that are on the record. And all of this, of course, was before the identification of the 1979 audit. But in thinking about these procedures, I just don't want the commission, nor do I want Mr. Gold, to believe that legal questions or issues are arising in the Reports Analysis Division and that there is no mechanism to have them raised with the Office of General Counsel, because there is such a mechanism. And in this case, those questions were answered. Does not mean that they were raised with the commission, and that, I imagine, is what you want to discuss further. And we can do that. But I did want to make that clarifying statement.
I appreciate that. And I guess there will be also some question in light of Mr. Gold's comments about how that those conclusions are. Is there some way in which we can convey back to the individual or entity being audited about those so that they're not left feeling like we're making arguments that are just falling on deaf ears? Again, last year at our procedures hearing, if there was one thing that that I think came through more clearly than anything else, was just the desire to, for one thing, to have an opportunity to present before the commission, but also to be heard. It seemed that there was wide spread frustration expressed that sometimes that arguments being made and concerns being raised were just not being heard by the commission, and if they were being heard, there was no substantive response being given back to the individuals raising those concerns or raising those issues. And so as we continue, and I think that this commission has done an excellent job at taking into account constructive criticisms and trying to develop new procedures. There have been a number of them that started under Chairman McGann's watch, and then last year under Chairman Walther's watch to improve those. And I think that those are, you know, that's an ongoing process where constant refinement is going to be necessary. And I think that that'll be healthy for us to continue that process to make sure that that it is as rational and makes as much sense as possible. I saw Ms. Ciccone.
I just wanted to clarify to Larry that, thank you, Tommy, for pointing that out. We did request the guidance, and just to remind you that after we did meet in September of 06, and that was actually after we received the guidance, and the Office of General Counsel was present at that meeting, and at that time you had indicated that you were going to go back to your client and see whether or not they were going to change their process. So you and I sort of went back and forth for about almost a year, because you had requested more time for after the 2006 election. It was busy, and which I understood. And then at that point, and then at that point, we finally did connect again, and you had told me that the process wasn't going to be changed. So, you know, you said that you didn't know why this was an audit issue, and at that point we weren't really sure what to do with it. It met our thresholds for audit, and we had already referred requested the informal guidance from the Office of General Counsel, so we went the audit route. There was no clarity on whether or not it was something, you know, we can see here today whether it was something that was permissible activity. So I just wanted to express again that I feel like we tried to work together on it, but you know, the time that went by, I think was both of our faults. I think it was a joint effort.
I acknowledged earlier and in the papers that we did have that meeting to discuss it, and you know, we were trying to understand what position was being asserted. We never got anything in writing. I appreciate that there was something in writing. My point is that early on in the process, we should have gotten a written response, substantive written response. And I'm not disagreeing with your recitation. I'm just saying I think that anybody in that situation, should have gotten a written response, legal response, responding to the points that we were making in extensive letters to RAD, because that was our only point of contact at that point, back and forth, and the letters that were all in the public record, for that matter. So I'll just end with that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, if there's nothing, Commissioner McGann.
It's actually a question for you, Mr. Chairman, because some of us have hinted around, and based upon counsel's explanation and procedurally what we can and can't do, I think it's up to you whether you would rule in order a motion to terminate the audit now, or is that something that needs to happen at another stage? Because I'm prepared to make the motion and support it if it's in order and you think it's the appropriate time. But as the chair, it's your decision as to whether or not that motion is properly made today or some other time.
I've kind of expressed where I stand on this particular one, and if we were to have that vote, I would.
You're not going to hurt my feelings either way.
Okay,
I'm asking procedurally, sure. And it's a new situation. I'm not urging you to do it, but I'm raising the question because we could save the AFL-CIO more resources. Although we do have to probably revisit some reporting issues per Commissioner Walther's ideas going forward, assuming that's where everyone. Or at least enough people land at the end of the day, but I don't want to rush anyone and force anything. But I just wanted to raise it. And it's an option that I would happily make the motion and move forward. But I'm not putting you on the spot. But you're the chair, so you have to decide.
I'm sympathetic to the substance of the motion. Since it's not something that I think is necessarily contemplated in our procedures, I'm somewhat reluctant to without having had an opportunity to discuss this amongst my colleagues about how we would execute that in this particular situation. And we may want to in the future do that, but in this particular setting, I'm a little reluctant to do it at this particular time. So, Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I also think that I would assume we would want to take an opportunity to whatever decision is made by the Commission to actually clarify the public record, because we do have on the record for this meeting itself this draft audit report. So it seems to me whatever action we want to take, we probably – at least I would think we would want to clarify what the position of the commission is. So it seems to me that is premature, and while, you know, it's not clear to me what's left of the audit if, you know, at this stage, so other than the work on our part to decide what to do with the recommendations of the division.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I agree with that. I believe that we're not costing Mr. Gold's client anything more at this point other than, you know, his time for the last hour and 35 minutes. But I think at this point he's waiting for us to make a decision and probably has a good sense of where we're going with this. But I also think that it probably would benefit from a little bit more discussion about exactly how we want to frame that decision.
Commissioner Hunter.
Following up on something that the Vice Chair said to the Audit Division, does the Audit Division ever change a draft audit report? It's my understanding that is not usually how you proceed.
If the commission makes a decision that the way this was done, you know, going back and forward is fine, then the audit report will reflect that.
Sorry, can you say that again?
The audit report will reflect what the commission decides on it.
The final audit report?
Yes.
But I'm talking about going back to the one that we're looking at, which I think is called the Audit Division's report.
That's draft. The draft final report.
Right. But you don't change that. Is that correct?
Well, that, you know, that is on the record at this point. You know, it's the document that Mr. Gold responded to. It's the document that was on the agenda for today. And so, you know, that exists. And so it seems to me that going, you know, the next thing the commission would see would be a final audit report, which could easily reflect the commission's decision on this.
So there's a way for us to, well, we can talk about this later, but there's a way for us to weigh in on it before a final audit report is issued.
I think we have a pretty good sense of where the commission is on this.
Okay, thank you.
Any further discussion? If not, I thank again, Mr. Gold, for your presentation today and your willingness to be here on back-to-back days under different circumstances. But again, your willingness to be here, I think this has been a very interesting and useful discussion. So if there's nothing more, meeting adjourned.
Thank you.